Welcome back to Radio Times. Is it harder making friends when you're an adult? Jerry Seinfeld thinks so. Here's a clip from a 1992 stand-up routine.
When you're in your 30s, it's very hard to make a new friend. But whatever the group is that you've got now, that's who you're going with. You're not interviewing, you're not looking at any new people, you're not interested in any seeing any applications. They don't know the places, they don't know the foods. They don't know the activities. If I meet a guy in a club or a gym or something, hey, look, I'm sure you're a very nice person. You seem to have a lot of potential. We're just not hiring right now. Of course, when you're a kid, you can be friends with anybody. You remember when you were a little kid, what are the qualifications? If someone's in front of my house now, that's my friend. They're my friend. That's it. Are you grown up? No? Great. Come on in. Let's jump up and down on my bed. And if you have anything in common at all, you like cherry soda, I like cherry soda, we'll be best friends.
Today on Radio Times, with that set up, we want to explore the challenges and rewards of adult friendship, and we want to look at how men and women bond, and we want your stories at 1-888-477-9499. We asked Andrea Bonnier to join us. She's a licensed clinical psychologist and adjunct professor in the psychology department at Georgetown University, also the author of a book called The Friendship Fix, The Complete Guide to Choosing, Losing, and Keeping Up with Your Friends, and she joins us from the studios of Georgetown University. And Andrea Bonnier, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. As a therapist, does the issue of friendship come up a lot with your patients?
A lot. In fact, a lot more often than you would think. Some people sort of start out therapy, and it seems to be about depression or anxiety. And then over time, it really becomes clear that what they're lacking is good friendships, or maybe they have terrible friendships, and those are really stressing them out.
And do you find interesting listening to that clip from Jerry Seinfeld, the idea that, the kids, you know, if you're in front of my house, you're my friend. If you have a bicycle, you're my friend. If I like you, you're my friend. As an adult, it's a lot more complicated than that.
Yes. Yes, I thought that was hilarious, but so true. I mean, it really is. And I have kids myself, and I see, you know, there's something about just being welcoming and accepting and being able to say, I can have fun with you for a half hour, therefore, let's have fun for a half hour. Whereas in adulthood, it can almost be harder than dating. You know, I've heard a lot of stories from women saying, hey, you know, give me dating any day over trying to find a new friendship, because it can be so much more awkward and so much more hand-wringing is involved.
Why is that? Why is that?
You know, I think one reason is probably because there's no real script. I mean, I think with dating, it's a little bit easier to say, okay, the person's either interested or not. And a lot of times with dating, you're sort of ultimately hoping for monogamy. Whereas with friendships, ultimately, you're hoping to sort of bring this person into a fold, and you might have two close friends, you might have 10 close friends. And so I think sometimes it's more likely that both people aren't going to be on the same page, and you just don't realize it. It's also easier, I think, to feel like a stalker. You know, it's like some people often say, hey, at least if somebody approaches me for my number in a bar, I kind of know the drill. You know, I understand what's going on. They're interested in dating, or you know, something a little bit less serious than dating, but they're interested in me romantically. Whereas how do you ask for someone's phone number when you're interested in friendship? You know, how do you start to take it to the next level of maybe hanging out with somebody at work versus doing something outside of work? Or maybe you're a mom and there's another mom at your kid's school that you'd love to have coffee with, but you feel kind of awkward just asking to have coffee. It can be really, really hand-wringing for people, I think.
And you think in those early days it is a form of dating? I mean, you like someone, you want to get to know them, perhaps meet them for coffee. That sounds sort of like a date.
It does. It does. You might even be wondering what you should wear and worrying about whether you're going to say the right thing. A lot of times it is. And I think women kind of joke about it, like, oh my goodness, I'm putting so much thought into this. I'm worried what she's going to think of me. And I'm worried that, you know, my apartment is clean enough, or that I'm doing such and such the right way. And it really does share some similarities with dating. But I think people are sort of ashamed to think of it in that way. They don't want to admit that they're sort of obsessing about trying to find friendships.
I'm thinking about the fact that so many of us work and have friends / colleagues at work. It is a place to find friends, and certainly to spend time with people. Is it potentially fraught to pursue a friendship at work?
You know, I think some really incredible friendships have been born out of work environments. And so I never want to discourage it altogether, but I think you're exactly right. Sometimes it's really a proceed with caution situation, because I've seen all types of things happen, from a friendship turning really solid and wonderful, and then it getting in the way of being colleagues. So for instance, your loyalty as a personal friend starts to make you perhaps less thoughtful in the decisions you make at work, or it sways you in some way from a professional level where you're not making good choices as a professional. And the other thing I think is true too, let's say you have a friendship that sort of goes bust, just like a romantic relationship at work, it comes with some peril. And so all of a sudden you still have to work with this person, and you know, and it gets in the way, and there's something that's kind of gone wrong, and it bleeds into the workplace, and frankly you can't get away from this person at this point. So I think in many ways there are complications, but if you think of how many hours we spend working, it seems pretty absurd that we wouldn't allow ourselves to get close to the people we work with. I think hopefully people can do it in a mindful way, because I tell you, I've seen it blow up more times than not when it gets too intense.
And you could be close without maybe even being a friend when it comes to work.
That's very true. That's very true. I think there's a way to sort of spend time with people in a collegial atmosphere where there's mutual support, but maybe you have a little bit more of a boundary than you would with somebody that you see a lot outside of work. I think, you know, oftentimes that's the way to test the waters, is have a little bit more of a boundary, and then maybe after some time has passed, you can think about breaking down that boundary a little bit and showing them a little bit more of yourself. But you do have to be careful.
I'm thinking about that Seinfeld clip where, you know, kids are sort of naturally gravitate towards each other. And I know for young parents, they often make friends through their children, through play groups, through school activities. And there can be such an intense bonding over this, you know, a raising of children together.
Yes, yes. I think it's a wonderful way for parents to make friends. You know, it's interesting because I think a lot of times if people were, you know, the first in their circle to have children, that can be kind of alienating. And so it almost becomes sort of comical, this search for parent friends or couple friends, because all we've, you know, our old friends haven't had kids yet, or they're never going to have kids, or they're single, or whatever the case may be. But then you automatically, you know, the more moving parts you throw into a friendship, the harder it can be, because it's like all of a sudden, okay, my children sort of have to get along. What if I really like spending time with this person, but our kids are at each other's throats? Or, oh my goodness, I really want to be friends with this parent because our kids get along so fabulously, but the friendship never seems to be taking off, you know, between the grown-ups.
Well, there are multiple ways. I mean, this is so obvious, but there are so many multiple ways to have friends and to be a friend to somebody, too.
And I think sometimes there's pressure for us to feel like, especially for women, that we need to put all of our eggs in a couple of friendship baskets, so to speak. And the truth is, you know, not all friendships have to be everything to us. There are some people that you might love, you know, going shopping with or working out with or that kind of thing, or cheering on your son's swim team with. But those aren't going to be the people that you call at 2 a.m. when your parent has been hospitalized. And so I think we need to accept that it's okay. You know, we don't have to be monogamous. It's wonderful to have best friends, but it's also wonderful to have a group of people that serve different roles in our lives.
Well, we are talking about friends, making friends in our adult years. Andrea Bonnier is our guest, and the lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Andrea, I'm probably a lot older than you are, and I'm thinking about how I've made new friends in the last couple of years, but I'm also pickier. I mean, I have to say that I think when you get older, you feel your sense of mortality. Mm-hmm. You feel like you don't want to waste time on things that you're really not interested in. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's a matter of shedding friendships, but also sort of reconnecting or bonding very, very strongly with people who you consider to be friends.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's probably a bit of a freedom in that. I've talked to women. In fact, I talked to a woman who finally got the courage to shed herself of a toxic relationship after having been friends with this person for 60 years. They met as young adults. She was in her early 80s. And she said, you know what? It's time. I finally can look at this objectively and say, my time is worth more than this. She has been nothing but a headache. She is selfish. She's always been selfish. And I'm going to cut myself loose. And it was very funny to see her children and her grandchildren's reaction. Like, what do you mean you're dumping this person? Because she had sort of semi been part of the family, but she had also been very toxic. And so I think there's a certain freedom in getting older and saying, I can live by my rules and value my time in a way that I don't have to keep friendships that are really not working for me.
My friends and I have a rule that we sometimes break, which is that we're not allowed to do organ recitals when we get together, which, and by that I mean we can't complain about our aching knees and our, you know, our sore necks and all the ailments that come with growing older. I mean, it's possible to bond over that stuff, but it's not, you know, I don't want anyone overhearing that conversation.
Right. And there is a fine line, I think, between sort of a mutual kvetching and giving each other support versus, okay, now this is just tearing all of us down. And now we're leaving this outing a lot more frustrated and down than when we entered.
I was doing some homework in preparation for today's show, and there seemed to be a certain criteria for friendship. One is proximity, the idea that you're close, literally physically close to someone, repeated unplanned interactions, and I'm just quoting here, and that's also a place where you can be your true self. Mm-hmm. Does that fit your definition of a true friendship?
Very much so. And I think that's why a lot of friendships sort of spring up organically in certain situations, you know, neighborhoods, workplaces, college. And that's why it can actually be harder, I think, once you've gone through a life transition. Maybe you have recently retired, or you've recently moved or relocated jobs or had children or whatever it is. It's like all of a sudden that natural proximity that made friendships so much easier to form is not there. You know, I always think about it, just the spontaneity of being able to make quick plans with somebody. It means so much. And when that's gone, you can really be left feeling like, yeah, I have a couple friends I could call and talk to, but I don't have anyone really to hang out with. And so I think it can be a rude awakening. But definitely, I think that's a great environment to grow friendships. When there is that ability to be yourself, there's the space and the context, and there are natural meetings that just occur spontaneously. The proximity is really, really important.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about friendships in the adult years. Andrea Bonnier is our guest. She's a licensed clinical psychologist, also an adjunct professor in the psychology department at Georgetown University. Wrote a book called The Friendship Fix, The Complete Guide to Choosing, Losing, and Keeping Up with Your Friends. We have a full bank of calls, and we have a guest waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about why friendship is good for your health. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Rittenhouse Square Fine Art Show supports WHYY and circles the square in Philadelphia's Rittenhouse Square at 18th and Walnut, Friday through Sunday, September 14th through 16th. Open Friday, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., Saturday, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Sunday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Featuring original artwork from over 140 locally and nationally recognized artists. A variety of paintings, prints, drawings, and sculptures will be exhibited. The Rittenhouse Square Fine Art Show. Details available at rittenhousesquareart.org.
Next time in Studio 360, have you ever noticed that pop songs these days are not so poppy?
I remember when we broke up the first time.
Why major hits are minor key. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
What?
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Thank you. It's been 11 years since the terrorist attacks on 9/11, and you may be thinking, how should I remember this day? But you might also be thinking, do the ceremonies and the remembrances help us heal or not? We'll ask psychiatrist Dr. Carl Bell and historian Kevin Levin about remembering tragic national events next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about adult friendships, and joining us now is Laura Carstensen. She's a professor of psychology and the Fairley S. Dickinson Jr. Professor in Public Policy at Stanford University, director of the Stanford Center on Longevity. And Laura Carstensen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. So is friendship good for our health?
Definitely it is. There is an abundant amount of information from research studies that have gone on over the past decade showing that the feeling of being embedded, part of something, some social group larger than just yourself, is essential for health and longevity. Even it predicts how long people will live.
And are we talking about mental health, physical health, a combination of the two?
Oh, it certainly affects mental health. That is, being around people who care about you and who you care about has obvious and direct links to mental health. But increasingly, we see that it's related to physical health as well.
In what way?
Well, the feelings that we have, the emotions that we have, are derived from.
You know what, I hate to say this, but we really have a terrible phone line. Perhaps, Laura, we'll try to call you back. But meantime, okay. We're going to call you back. But meanwhile, I'll carry on my conversation with Andrea Bonnier. And Andrea, just picking up on what Laura was saying about, and it shouldn't surprise us, that friendships, social relationships are good for our mental and physical health.
They really are. And I think the physical piece is what really does surprise people. You know, there's immune system research that says the more friends we have, the better it is for our immune system. And is it just that, you know, perhaps we're surrounded with more germs that sort of we get desensitized to? Mm. It's also probably that the stress relief that good social support can provide is worth so much to us physically. It makes us better able to ward off disease or small things like colds and flu. It helps probably with things like blood pressure, you know, all of those things, the mind-body connection, we're just scratching the surface. And I think friendships are so integral to that. And there's been research saying that they might be one of the biggest predictors in terms of longevity, which I think is really surprising for people. We definitely need friends and dementia as well. I mean, when you look at older generations, it's actually very, very good for your brain to be continuing to have social interaction in meaningful ways. It really helps ward off some dementia.
Well, and I'm thinking for older people, obviously they have lived a long life. They probably have lost loved ones. Mm-hmm. Their social circle, their social world can shrink pretty dramatically. It can be harder to maintain friends when you're losing them.
It is, and it can be harder just to keep the logistics of staying in touch. I mean, it can be, you know, once you're a little too shaky to write a letter or your hearing's not so great on the phone, you can imagine the impediments that exist. And that's why I think it's really important for those of us that are caregivers for older generations to keep that in mind, that it is so crucial to try to keep those connections going for them, because that's also a tie to their past. And there's been some research that says, you know, that can help them make meaning of the lives that they have lived in order to, you know, see those connections continuing and to be able to reminisce and have a sense of nostalgia about their lives with their friend community.
Again, in preparation for the show, I was actually thinking about my grandmother-in-law. I always thought of her as my grandmother, but she had this very close circle of friends. These were women in their 90s. They live in an apartment building. They checked on each other every single day. If one went to the supermarket and someone needed a carrot, they would pick up a carrot for them. They gossiped together. If one of them got sick, they would, you know, make chicken soup and really watched out for each other. Now, she lived to be 105 and some change. I'm not saying it's because of that, but I was always so moved about just the intensity of the relationship these women had.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that sounds amazing. That sounds like a wonderful sense of community that she was able to keep going. And I think, you know, oftentimes when people reach what seems to be phases towards the end of their life, the focus is so much on family. But I think we do ourselves a real disservice when we forget about the friendships and the importance of keeping up those friendships. And, you know, I think it should definitely be taken into consideration in terms of living environment when people are making decisions about where someone should be or what nursing home or what retirement community. I would put the ability to keep good friendships going and make new friendships at the top of the list in that type of choice.
I'm sorry to say that we cannot reconnect with Laura Carstensen. We just couldn't get a good phone line there. But, Andrea, we will continue with you. And Andrea Bonnier, licensed clinical psychologist, author of The Friendship Fix, and adjunct professor in the psychology department at Georgetown University. We are talking about adult friendships today on Radio Time, some of the challenges and certainly some of the rewards. And we have just one or two open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get to Joe from Mount Airy to join our conversation. And Joe, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi,
Andrea. I wanted to chime in and just really tell you how really right on, spot on this all is. Having lost my best friend of over 35 years, we met when we were 8 years old last year to a sudden heart attack. It's almost like a piece of you leaves because that history that you were talking about is so difficult to reconnect with in adult life. Those are the shared experiences, kind of what makes a marriage, if you will. People say, let's build a life together. Well, in essence, you know, when you have a best friend, it's like that kind of a partnership.
Joe, I appreciate the call, and I can hear in Andrea's voice, and I think anyone that has lost a lifelong friend like that can experience with you what that loss has meant to you. Let me give Andrea a chance to weigh in. Your thoughts?
Yeah, my sincerest condolences, first of all, because I think that can be really devastating. And like you said, it's not just missing the current company of this person, which is no doubt huge in and of itself, but it's also thinking about, okay, this piece of my history, this connection to who I was 30 years ago, now seems to have been diminished. And I think it's important to take with you the fact that, you know, although no one will ever replace this person, the fundamental aspects of friendship that made this relationship so great can eventually be initiated with somebody else. But again, I'm so sorry to hear about your loss.
And it's important to mourn that loss, is it not?
Very much so. And I think that's another thing that our society doesn't really have a script for. You know, we have words for widow and widower, or certainly someone who's lost a parent. I think there's kind of an idea in our society of how we might help that person. But when somebody's lost a close friend, there is no prescripted notion of what that looks like. And as you mentioned, it can feel very much like losing a spouse in certain ways. It can be a very significant loss.
Well, especially for Joe, who had a friend for 35 years, which is, you know, a long time. Joe, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Christina from Morristown, New Jersey has to say. Christina, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was just calling to say I don't really know if I believe that once you're beyond a certain age, you can really make a real friend, no matter what you have in common, because I just feel like, you know, everybody's got their lives to live, and yeah, okay, you have acquaintances, and, you know, like you were saying earlier, there's people, you know, you go and you cheer your kids on with some people and things like that, but these aren't people you can call at 2 o'clock in the morning and stuff like that, so.
I mean, it sounds like you're saying, Kristen, are you not interested, or you feel like you don't have time, or are you not going to get back what you think you're looking for?
Well, no, I just, I guess I'm not getting what I would be looking for. I'm not sure exactly what I was looking for. I mean, I think it's kind of a myth because, there's, you know, in movies you always see like in, I don't remember, there was some Meryl Streep movie where she's sitting around with her girlfriends and they're all drinking wine and talking about what a schmuck her ex-husband is. And I'm just like, I could never see that. You know?
I hear you, Christine. Yeah. I appreciate the call. Go ahead, Andrea.
Yeah, you know, I think it is a lot harder. I think you're absolutely right. And for some people, it really feels impossible. I can definitely relate to that, and I can definitely say that I've heard many women relate to that. But I would argue that when you really make it a goal and you make yourself open to the types of activities that are going to hopefully put you in situations to make new friends, it can be done. I mean, we don't have to be done. Our friendships don't have to be set in our 30s and 40s and then no more to come along. I think that's one thing that actually can be great about technology. I mean, I think there are actually a lot of drawbacks to Facebook and Twitter and tweeting in terms of the quality of friendships. But there are also groups online. You know, there are ways to start a book club or meet up with other people in your neighborhood through a community listserv, or exposing yourself to volunteer opportunities that you might not have known about that you now see online. I think part of it does take a commitment to say, this is something that I feel that I want, and I'm going to make some effort to do it. And it might feel awkward, and it might feel impossible sometimes, and sometimes I might even get rebuffed because I'm trying to start a friendship and it doesn't seem to be taking off. But I think if you can really value it, I have definitely worked with many women who have made it happen, and they felt like it was impossible, and that's why they decided to try to commit to it in therapy, and they have made it happen. But I think you're absolutely right that it can be a lot harder to do, and it can be really tough for people.
Christina, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Ann from Chestnut Hill has to say. Ann, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Marty.
Hi,
Andrea. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to call because I think that there is a dangerous proposition in making friends with people around your kids. And the reason I say that is that I had an experience where I had a very close friendship with someone because our children liked each other, and we started developing a friendship. But unfortunately, through the course of the friendship, I started to see some real red flags about that person's parenting style that was in direct conflict with mine. Mm-hmm. And as a result, my daughter also started to have some difficulties with the other child. And what ended up happening, unfortunately, is that we had a whole group of friends, and when I decided that friendship was more fraught with anxiety than that sense of well-being or rejuvenation that should come with a friendship, I ended the friendship, and unfortunately, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. You would like to think that it's not like high school cliques, but all those other women then ended up no longer being my friend.
Oh, and let me give Andrea a chance to weigh in on that. And I know you're not alone in that. Andrea, go ahead.
Oh, yes. Unfortunately, you're far from alone in that. And first of all, I'm so sorry to hear that that has happened. And I think what you really speak to there is that it is a double-edged sword, not just forming friendships with other parents when it's sort of based on your children, but also this notion of the group that you talk about. I've worked with many women and spoken with many women who say, okay, I love this group except one person in it, and I have had a falling out, and what do I do now? I can't and, you know, just go there and ignore this one person. It's sort of a package deal, and it does start to feel like high school. And I think it's a terrible reality that for many women, some of those same feelings come up, the feelings of being snubbed or wondering if somebody's gossiping about you behind your back or you're being ganged up on. And so I think you're absolutely right to proceed with caution. But it is a double-edged sword, though, because I think sometimes as parents, other parents can really sort of understand your life in a way that is specifically meaningful. So sometimes these friendships can be among the most rewarding, and sometimes it's logistically easier to make friends with parents because they'll understand you can get all the families together and you don't have to get a babysitter, and you know, you can sort of kill two birds with one stone if the kids like each other. But you're absolutely right. I mean, what you talk about really is sort of the worst case scenario, and I've seen it happen more than a few times.
And I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Andrea, is there a graceful way to break up with a friend?
You know, there are a few. I mean, what I usually advise as a first step is to try to do that gradual fade. You know, it means sort of lengthening the amount of time that would go in between communications, not you know, initiating as many communications, not getting as in-depth in each other's lives in terms of when you do talk. But there really is a fine line between doing that versus being passive-aggressive or stringing someone along. So I think the only way that that gentle fade-out typically works is when both parties are on the same page and you sort of naturally do this dance where you kind of step out of each other's lives in a respectful way. End of story, no harsh words, it's done. Sometimes the person is really not getting the hint, or the person thinks, hey, why are you backing off? Have I done something wrong? And when that starts to happen, you might see them push back further. And then you really have to be a little bit more direct. And it's terribly awkward for people.
Sure.
People never want to do this. But I've spoken with many women who say, you know, I really would have wished that whoever it was, Sarah, Emily, whatever, would have told me, okay, I'm feeling some distance between us now. My life is going in a different direction. I could have accepted that. Instead, I was left wondering what went wrong. And that can be really tough, that ambiguity. So you always have to be respectful.
I would think there's probably some degree of guilt in breaking up with a friend.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I think women oftentimes are really guilty of feeling too guilty, if I can say that, because we hold on to these toxic friendships and we say, well, I can, you know, just kind of keep her around. Lunch every once in a while isn't going to do much harm. But we spin ourselves into this frenzy of drama and we feel too guilty to cut them loose. And, you know, I never advise somebody to cut somebody loose if they're suffering through a period of something difficult. I mean, sometimes, for instance, if someone's depressed, they can be a terrible friend. But if it's a long-standing pattern of relationship dysfunction, at some point you need to say, I deserve better than this.
We were talking about some of the criteria from friendship, a place where you can be your true self, a place where you feel like you can relax. You don't have to pretend to be somebody else. You can, you know, be at your worst and your friend will still like you and accept you.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful thing, really.
It is. I'm thinking of also defriending, which, of course, it's easy to do that on something like Facebook, but defriending someone who's physically in your life, as you mentioned, can be more complicated.
Much more complicated. And just like good friendships can feel kind of like a marriage, I think a defriend can sometimes feel even worse than a divorce. I mean, I spoke with women who literally said, you know, I'm finally over my divorce, but this one friendship that blew up and ended in a spectacularly horrible way, I still cringe about it and I'm not over it. I mean, it's intense stuff when a friendship goes badly.
And is that just because it's a relationship that doesn't have the same kind of ground rules, perhaps, that a marriage does?
Yeah, I think so. Because I think sometimes with friendships, one person thinks it's over and the other person doesn't realize it. I mean, typically when you're served with divorce papers,
exactly,
you sort of realize. But with friendships, I mean, I spoke with women who say, look, as far as I'm concerned, this is done. But then every once in a while, she acts like nothing's changed. And there I have to sort of, you know, say, no, I can't go have brunch or whatever it is. Or I spoke with one woman who literally was so scared of passing this one friend on the street. They'd been very close friend for 10 years, but then the person was so manipulative. So she would walk down the street afraid of seeing this person because she thought, what would I say? This is going to be horrible.
Oh, goodness. Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our callers and our conversation. Andrea Bonnier is our guest. She's a licensed clinical psychologist. We are talking about adult friendships. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to transforming healthcare to make a better coordinated system that is built around you. They're committed to leading the way to focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it, pioneering new ways to pay healthcare professionals based on the quality of care, and using technology to update your medical information electronically so everyone can be informed. Further details online at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross, changing the game.
On the next Fresh Air, we're joined by an extraordinarily cute 11-week-old puppy who is about to be trained to do extraordinary work as a search and rescue dog. We talk with the founder of the University of Pennsylvania's new working dog center, Dr. Cynthia Otto. She worked with dogs at Ground Zero. And we'll meet the center's training director, Anne-Marie D'Angelo. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's Daytime News Magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up, plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture, Here and Now. Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Andrea Bonnier. She's the author of a book called The Friendship Fix, The Complete Guide to Choosing, Losing, and Keeping Up with Your Friends. We are talking about the rewards and challenges of adult friendship. And I do want to play a scene from the 1989 movie When Harry Met Sally, written by Nora Ephron. Let's listen.
You realize, of course, that we could never be friends.
Why not?
What I'm saying is, and this is not a come on in any way, shape, or form, is that men and women can't be friends because the sex part always gets in the way.
That's not true. I have a number of men friends and there is no sex involved.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
You only think you do.
You're saying I'm having sex with these men without my knowledge?
No, what I'm saying is they all want to have sex with you.
They do not.
Do too.
They do not.
Do too.
How do you know?
Because no man can be friends with a woman that he finds attractive. He always wants to have sex with her.
So you're saying that a man can be friends with a woman he finds unattractive?
No, you pretty much want to nail him, too.
Another scene, or another clip during this hour talking about friendship, When Harry Met Sally. So do you agree with Harry, Andrea, that men and women cannot be friends because of sex?
You know, it's interesting. I think a few years ago I would have said, oh, that's nonsense. But there has been some research that points to this, that heterosexual men do endorse having typically some romantic and sexual feelings toward their closest female friends. And I think that comes as a surprise to women because the women don't typically endorse the same feelings.
Is that a bad thing?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think it can be a bad thing when it threatens a romantic relationship or when it's unrequited to the point where what keeps your relationship going is the hope that this person will then become romantically interested in you. I've certainly seen that happen. You know, one person's kind of hanging on because they think, ooh, maybe I'm next in line if this person ever gets separated from their current partner. And the other person is so unaware of that and has no plans ever for making them next in line. And that can be a potentially emotionally devastating situation. Some people might argue, though, that a low-level attraction, you know, that's the very thing that makes you want either a friendship or a romantic partner. Someone's interesting, they're intelligent, they make you laugh. I think there is some overlap between what you look for in a friend and what you look for in a partner.
Let me get Mary from Pomona, New Jersey, to join our conversation. And Mary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Mary. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. I live in senior housing, and I've lived here for 14 years. I've seen people come and go. About 6 months after I moved here, I made a friend with a gentleman. We were friends until he passed. We were friends for 10 years. Now, I have seen the people here in this building not accepting where they are at this point in their life. They're still back to where they were before. At this age, we all have a change of income. We all have a change of surroundings, physical surroundings. And I feel it's non-acceptance. There are many activities that are provided here in this building, as well as activities provided by the community that we live in. There's just people that stay in their apartments and come out for very few things. And I honestly feel that this is their own personality. Granted, some of these people indeed do have physical problems that keep them from coming out, but there are many that are not.
Well, Mary, I appreciate your call, and I can see looking at my computer here, you're 82 years old. You're obviously outgoing because you're calling into a radio show. But she's talking, Andrea, about what she observes in her senior living facility, and that people staying in their apartment, not taking advantage of all the potential social opportunities that are there.
Right, Marty. I mean, I think it is really easy to get stuck in a rut, and I applaud the caller so much for putting forth effort and realizing that, hey, I've still got plenty of years left, and I want to make the most of them and reach out and make the most of my situation. I think she's absolutely right, though. There are people who it's really tough, and they kind of are doing themselves a disservice without necessarily realizing it. They sort of, you know, the more passive you become and the more isolated you become, that perpetuates itself very easily. And so bravo to her for really keeping busy and active with social relationships. But I think there are a lot of people that maybe they know would be good for them, but it's too hard to break the inertia.
Mary, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Andrea, we've talked a lot about women's friendships with each other. Is there something we should know about how men bond with each other? Is there something unique about male friendships?
There are definitely some interesting differences. I think some of them we sort of think about in pop cultural ways, too. There have been TV shows that kind of show these. For instance, you know, men seem to feel more comfortable basing relationships more on activities. You know, even though you kind of see guys hanging out, oftentimes it's, okay, we're going to watch the game, or we're going to do this, that, or the other. There's something more specific. By the same token, though, men seem to be a little bit more forgiving in their friendships. They seem to be able to let some drama unfold and not have it wreck the equilibrium of the relationship. In general, though, men do seem to say that they're not sure if they have enough friends. I think it's a common refrain from wives, actually, to say, you know, my husband doesn't seem to have any friends, and it's always up to me to kind of set him up on play dates with other husbands and that kind of thing. So there are some differences, but I think, honestly, some of them are eroding, because if you look at younger generations now, you really start to see groups of friends from both men and women. And I think men and women are relating to each other in a little bit more similar ways in terms of friendship than they used to, you know, despite what Harry from When Harry Met Sally said.
Well, we should say that goes back to 1989, so it's almost ancient history. I mean, I have to say I've observed some of the men in my life having what I would call as true bromances. I mean true love and affection for the men in their life.
Yeah. I think we do men a real disservice by assuming that their relationships are somehow less emotionally intimate than women's. And I think it might just sometimes show itself in different ways. You know, they might not call it, we're going to go and discuss her love life and give her support, or it's going to be...
Heaven forbid, right?
But they really do provide that role for each other, you know? I mean, I've often seen some of my husband's friends, for instance, really provide some pretty significant emotional support for each other. They just do it in a way that is kind of, you know, there aren't any loudspeakers blaring, I'm providing emotional support right now.
They're so much better than we are they not?
They do make it seem easier.
They
sometimes
do, indeed. Let me get Sharon from Downingtown to join us. Hi, Sharon. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
I just wanted to call in. I'm one of those people who makes friends really easily. And the joke when I was a kid was I would just walk down the beach and say, I'll play with you until somebody said yes. I've kind of taken that into my adult life, even though I have a couple of serious obstacles. I have a handicapped child at home, and I also have an autoimmune disease that made me quit working. Oh, so getting out of the house at all is not so easy. But I realized I've made like four really good friends I can call in the middle of the night the last couple of years just by perseverance. And I think what that means is, like, one of the things I tried was a neighbor pulled me into a book group that was based from people from her church. And I thought it was going great. I missed any kind of signal that might have been thrown out. But 6 months in, I got an email from somebody that said, please don't come back.
Oh, good.
And I was just shocked. And then I realized I was able to externalize that and say, well, you know, their church is going through a tough time, and they needed to be able to privately kvetch about it. And it wasn't anything really to do with me. So I think part of it is just being able to externalize any rejection you get and keep on going. And then, you know, you hit enough people, you resonate with enough people that you have enough friends.
Well, I'm glad. Sounds like you have some very intense friendships there, Sharon. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Andrea, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, you know, I think you are very good at doing what a lot of people are not very good at, which is getting over what seems like a rejection and saying, this is par for the course, this is part of the process. And I think oftentimes that's an obstacle for people in making new friends, because there's going to be some situations that feel like rejection. It's just that simple. Some friendships aren't going to take off. And as long as you're respectful and you're not kind of using people and then dumping them, I think that's a reasonable expectation. Okay, this didn't go anywhere. I'm going to try somebody else. And, you know, you're good at not taking that personally. A lot of people, it is a real personal thing, and it harkens back to any other rejection they've ever felt in their life, and they're kind of carrying all that with them. So it's very, very tough. I would also say, though, it's important to look at patterns. And it sounds like with your situation, it was an isolated incident for sure. Some women, though, will come to me and they'll say, you know, I'm just no good with friendships. Women hate me. Ooh. And you sort of look at this pattern and you're thinking, you know, this person probably does have a role. I mean, certain situations you can say, it was about what the other people were going through. But some women, there's really a pattern there that deserves to be looked at.
Meaning that if there's a pattern, I should look at my own behavior to see what role I've played in creating this pattern?
Exactly. And it can be many things, from maybe just picking the wrong people to actively having some personality dynamic that you come in with, whether it's competitiveness or jealousy, or you're kind of hot and then you're cold, or you can't be relied on, or you ask too much, or you give too much. Any of those things can throw a friendship off balance repeatedly.
Sharon, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Leslie from Wyomissing has to say. Leslie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for the program.
You're welcome.
I just noticed that decade by decade, the way I made friendships have changed. I had a deal of friends coming out of college, but I chose a career path in medicine, which kept me in school basically until I'm in my 30s. So my friends that went the marriage route and had children, although we'd send Christmas cards and things like this, we didn't have, when we got together, we had nothing to talk about. Because I'd be talking about taking a board exam, and they'd be, you know, involved in kindergarten. And it's just, we didn't have anything. Although we said we were friends, we never did anything together. So I think the 30s were friendless. Interesting, the 40s, I had friends, mostly were guys. And it's just because I think a work-related situation. I could not have children, and I did not marry. So my friendships have been my grounding. But I notice now I'm in my 50s, I'm 54, and I have a lot of friends because children, the issue of children is no longer there, because either they're empty nesters, they may have grandchildren, and I'll go with them to see their grandchildren do something, but I just saw that people who had children weren't interested in me. Either they lost interest or never became interested in me. And now I have friends from all different spectrums, the professional, people who've been stay-at-home artists, people who, and we all do different things together. And sometimes we get together as a group, and it's very different. So at 54, I'm really loving life. It's working out.
Well, Leslie, it's a great call. I appreciate that. And I love the way you put that into those decades. Andrea, you want to add to that?
Yeah, it sounds like you've really got something going that works really well for you right now, and I applaud you for that. And I do think you're absolutely right. I mean, sometimes when that whole kid, no kid divide takes over, I've seen some really real good friendships, you know, sort of come to an end, I think, because of that. And I think sometimes there's room for blame on both sides. There are certainly parents who are incapable of really listening to the concerns of people who don't have kids, because they just think, oh, it pales in comparison to what I'm going through. But then there are also people who don't have kids who aren't really interested in hearing even just a little bit about the parenting that aspect of daily life that the other person is subsumed with. But for you, it's really interesting that you've seen that through the span. And now it sounds like your friendships, you have a real nice variety of people that you have the freedom to have many good years of friendships with.
Leslie, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And we are nearly out of time, Andrea, but we haven't really talked about couples and how couples can or sometimes don't work as friends. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Definitely. I think there are so many ways that this can go wrong, and I've seen people in search of that holy grail. You know, once they pair off in a significant romantic relationship, or they get engaged, or they get married, they think, okay, now we've got to find our soulmates, our couple soulmates. Right. And unfortunately, it rarely happens just that way. You know, again, just so many moving parts in a relationship, there are more things that can go wrong. So I've seen, you know, people try to blend the friends, like, okay, well, he has his friends and I have my friends, maybe we can kind of turn everybody into one big group, and that doesn't go so well. I think one of the most common pitfalls is if you're not a fan of one part of the couple, and then you want to sort of hang out with the one, but the other one, does it have to be a package deal? And I say, you know, take a friendship for what it is. You don't have to be renting a beach house together every year with everybody there. If you're not fond of your friend's husband, you're going to just do solo things with her, and vice versa. Or, you know, if your spouse has friends that you're not really fond of, he gets to hang out with them without you every once in a while. I think the biggest difficulty emotionally is when you say, wow, how does my spouse have these people as friends? It makes me actually sort of, you know, I don't like these people, and I don't know why he would want to spend his valuable time. And that gets in the way of the marriage, because it makes them have a negative opinion of their spouse. And that gets tricky, certainly.
Well, we're going to end on that tricky note. Andrea Bonnier, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty. It's been so much fun.
Fun for us as well. The book is called The Friendship Fix, and she's a licensed clinical psychologist. Fred Snyder, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen, and we want to close things out with a song for the Beatles, With a Little Help from My Friends.
What do I do when my love is away? Does it worry you to be alone? How do I feel by the end of the day? Are you sad because you're on your own? No, I get by with a little help from my friends. Get high with a little help from my friends. Gonna try with a little help from my friends.